All right, welcome back from lunch. I hope you all enjoyed the presentation from our Chief Economist, Avery Shenfield. Next up, we have AGF Management, and representing AGF is Adrian Basaraba, CFO. So Adrian was appointed to the position of CFO in 2016, and is a member of the executive management team. Adrian originally joined AGF in 2004, so has been there, I guess, roughly 15 years. When was your 15-year anniversary?
It was recent. It was April.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
And I think it's your first time joining us in Montreal, so thanks for the time, and we look forward to the chat. So where I want to start is in with respect to the improvement in retail fund sales. So you've come a long way from the firm's perspective. Achieved positive net sales in 2018, and it was the first year of positive net flows in over 10 years. And I know there were a number of actions that contributed to the sales improvement, but can you highlight what you think were the most important two or three items?
Absolutely, and thank you for having me here, Paul, and good afternoon, everyone. Yeah, I would say there was three things that contributed to the improvement. The first would be our brand. So in 2017, we celebrated a 60-year anniversary, and we changed our logo, and we came out with a brand refresh and campaign. So for those of you who are familiar with our logo, it's always been a tiger. And for many years, it was a tiger sort of running away from you. And the new logo, if you're familiar with it, is a tiger staring you in the eye. It's a friendly-looking tiger, but it is staring directly at you. And we sort of came up with a new mission, which is to bring stability to the world of investing. And we've got a new tagline, which is invested in discipline. And so refreshing the brand was really important as far as just kind of reestablishing that connection with our clients and, you know, being able to talk about a new and different way of doing business. And if you think about the mission statement that I just mentioned, you know, stability and discipline are some words that we use. And that's sort of leading into the second thing, which was really on the investment performance, the way we manage money. We observed quite clearly that coming out of the global financial crisis in 2008, clients were a lot more concerned about drawdowns. They're concerned about managing risk, and effectively, they don't want to lose money. And so, our current CEO and Chief Investment Officer Kevin McCreadie, who's been at the firm for 5 years, really instilled a discipline in the portfolio management process. And really changed the way we manage money to not necessarily trying to catch the last nickel or be in the top decile for every strategy, but more so managing the portfolios with discipline. And that's worked out well. And I think the industry is changing a little bit in the sense that investors, they still want, you know, products that perform well, but they understand now that the top decile performer of today is probably the bottom decile performer of tomorrow. And so I think there's been a maturity, again, after the global financial crisis. And then the last thing I think was just process improvement. So we sort of realized that, you know, having great products and managing them the right way isn't enough. We have to really change how we interact with clients. And so we started with the client. We went into depth in terms of what our clients want as far as service and what they want to see from an asset manager. And we built out our processes from the client, around the client, and I think that really contributed to this re-engagement. So the changing in the process of how we interact with clients, new brand, a way of managing money that really resonates with clients, I think those were all contributing factors.
Okay. Well, I mean, those are three great examples of things that have good momentum to them and should be enduring. But are there any particular changes of focus or new items where you can point to in terms of keeping the sales momentum going?
Yeah, I mean, I think keeping the sales momentum going now is about offering new and different things that our clients are interested in. And so we were on the road last week across Canada talking to our clients about alternatives. And part of the reason why we were doing that is that they're effectively telling us that this is where they want to get some exposure. You know, markets have been grinding higher, but there's still some volatility there. If you think about, you know, geopolitical news and drone attacks and impeachment and all those things, you know, people are looking for sources of uncorrelated returns and also opportunities to hedge what they're doing. And so I think those are some of the things that we'll focus on. We're also going to focus on strategic partnerships. Because of some of the unique capabilities we have, there's quite a few partners in Canada, you know, that will do things themselves in-house, but they will look to organizations such as AGF to supplement what they're doing. And so we'll do a lot more work with our strategic partners. And then, you know, I think those are probably the two big ones.
So can you just clarify for the benefit of everyone in the audience what you mean by strategic partnerships without getting into specific names, but maybe sort of give some flavor and context?
Yeah, so for us, a strategic partner is any firm that really wants to do more than just a transaction with us. So we have partners that rely on us for thought leadership. They rely on us to, you know, help train their sales force. We have clients that the relationship is just simply deeper. And using Liquid Alts as an example, which we can get into later, I just heard yesterday that there's a large bank in Canada, one of the big ones, who is planning a roadshow across the country to educate their broker network on Liquid Alts, and AGF is the sole partner to help them do that. So, you know, that's an example of an organization that we think, you know, we can partner with more so because we're not just bringing them products, we're bringing them thought leadership and helping them actually train their people to understand what's happening with the new area of the market. The Liquid Alts market has opened up to financial advisors in Canada because of some new regulations. So that's the context behind that.
Okay. One of the biggest challenges facing the industry today and a challenge to net sales is pricing and fee pressure. How's AGF responding to the price question?
Yeah, so I guess there's a couple of things there. We've taken the pricing concern very seriously. In 2017, we did some major price reductions across our platform to get it to a point where it is now, you know, competitive with the industry. In 2018, we introduced a lowest fee series, which effectively gives a discount for accounts that are greater than $100,000. And then we're also launching, you know, new products that are very price competitive. So, for example, quant funds, ETFs that can be purchased for a reasonable price.
Okay. Actually, let's get into the quantitative capabilities that AGF has been building up. So it's been an area of investment for you now for a number of years, including a transaction you did in the U.S. What are the primary reasons you decided to go down that path, and what do you think are going to be the primary benefits going forward?
Yeah, I mean, if you tie it into our strategy, you know, we've been a global firm observing markets, you know, over the years, and really we look to the U.S. for trends that will potentially happen in Canada. And so, you know, if you look at the U.S. market today, 40% of mutual fund AUM is in passive, right? And that's, you know, greater than it is in Canada, but Canada is trending towards that. And we saw this happen starting with, you know, probably a decade ago, and thinking about how that might affect our strategy. Early on, what we did is we tried to focus primarily on global mandates because global emerging markets, both on the equity and fixed income side, are, you know, more difficult to solve with an index, and there's more, you know, imperfect information. And then as we moved more into this phenomenon in Canada where people were looking more so at, you know, passive investing and lower fees, which you mentioned earlier, we started to get more into quantitative investing and factor-based because, you know, this is strategically an alternative to passive. So, you know, if somebody is going to consider or someone has chosen they want to go down the passive route, it's going to be probably pretty difficult to convince them to go fully into a fundamental strategy, but you can convince them that, you know, passive investing, it may not be for everyone. There are some inherent risk or even systematic risk within passive investing, and here's a way to do it differently. It's a way that, you know, you can still differentiate yourself as an advisor and not look like a robo-advisor, have an active portfolio that, you know, you can still differentiate yourself, but, you know, have a lower fee and have it be more benchmark aware. So it really ties in, the quantitative investing really ties into our strategy around, you know, the core of the portfolio being indexed away, competing with that.
So as a CFO, as you think about the quantitative strategies, they are obviously provided at a lower price point. How do you think about the margins there? Are they comparable margins to what you get on a fully active fundamental fund?
Yeah, as far as the margins go, the one good thing about it is that, you know, the quantitative investing styles are very scalable. So particularly the, you know, global type mandates, you don't necessarily have to hire more team members to start doing bottoms up analysis on more, you know, on more companies as you build out new strategies. It's highly scalable. But we kind of feel like quantitative investing is not really a choice, or having a quantitative capability. If you think about the amount of data that is out there and available, as an investment manager, if you're not going to look at it, somebody else is going to look at it. And so, you know, we've been spending quite a bit of time building our team. We have 20 quantitative professionals, six of them have PhDs, and we're building a very large database of information and looking at ways that we can use that quantitative information to make predictions that can help our portfolio managers. We're not trying to have an artificial intelligence fund where it's running by itself or there's a robot running it. But an example I'll give is we spent 3 years essentially downloading conference call transcripts and turning them into zeros and ones and analyzing whether there are things that are said by CEOs or CFOs that are statistically significant and can you know, predict share price movement in the future. And so, you know, that kind of thing now allows us to turn massive amounts of information or data into information that can be used by our PMs. It's not taken, you know, we don't take the information and say, well, here's a portfolio based on this algorithm, but it's just an example of, you know, there's a lot of data out there. You know, I do believe investment management firms have to learn how to use it because I think those that don't will be at a competitive disadvantage.
And your quantitative push is not just limited to Canadian retail funds either. You're looking at growing, where you are growing already in other markets. So maybe talk a little bit about that, what's happening in the U.S., the institutional market.
Yeah, so yeah, a lot of people are focused now on the Canadian market because of the liquid alternative rules that recently came into effect. And you've seen there's about 40 funds in Canada that would, well, you know this better than I because you wrote a great report on it. But and I think there's about $4 billion of AUM in liquid alts in Canada. A lot of that AUM, I think, was transferred from strategies that went from private into this liquid strategy. But, you know, Paul wrote a great report on it. There's a lot of growth expected in that market. But people who are tackling it in the Canadian space, in some cases, you know, they've got strategies that they have developed over a fairly short period of time to seize this new opportunity. We bought a company in 2014 called FFCM. We put that together with our quantitative capabilities in Canada. FFCM was one of the first companies in the U.S. to get exemptive relief to short inside an ETF. So we've got 8-year track records on quantitatively managed liquid alts, and we've managed them live in the U.S. So we feel as though you know, the products that we're going to launch in Canada, you know, will be regarded as, you know, having being of decent quality because we have an experience doing this in the U.S. for a very long time. So there's a couple strategies in Canada that we're going to launch very shortly. One of them is a long short anti beta fund. It'll be launched next week actually, and the ticker is QBTAL. And then we're going to do another strategy, which is a 100% long, 50% short dividend strategy, which basically gives you equity-like income with fixed income type of risk. And that's going to be in a ETF format. The ticker's QUDV, just in case any of you are interested in typing them up now. And it's going to be available in an ETF and a mutual fund. So while these are new funds, we've been managing these types of strategies in the U.S. Again, having an 8-year live track record on liquid alt strategies with a team of 26 of them being PhD. Some of these people have been doing this stuff for 20 years. We think that puts us in a very unique position within the Canadian marketplace.
Good. And then next question, it's not a new one. It's been one that's been asked to AGF many times. But I think it's an important one, which is AGF does not directly own any distribution or have a network of financial advisors in Canada. Strategically and operationally, I mean, how do you navigate around that?
Yeah, so I think not having distribution is, you know, can be a benefit. It can be a challenge as well. You know, the benefit that we see is that, you know, we can be a partner that doesn't necessarily compete with you. So, for example, the example that I gave with the bank platform that we're partnering very closely with, we've got, you know, a handful of strategic partners where operationally the relationship has become so close that it's hard to distinguish where our firm ends and theirs starts. You know, and that's just the example of a really, really close partnership. We also think that with the new rules on, you know your product, know your client, and other regulatory changes that are happening, there's been a suggestion by the regulators that companies are going to have to declare whether they're going to be open or they're going to be tied, right? And so we think certain organizations will decide to be, you know, fully in-house products, and others will choose to be more open, and that will be a selling feature for them. And so, for AGF, being an independent firm with a strong brand, we think there's going to be new opportunities to partner with these organizations should they choose to declare themselves to be open. Okay. And I guess we also feel like, you know, for us at this point, we've chosen our path and we're executing on it. We don't really feel as though we could start a strategy of acquiring distribution and build up a meaningful enough amount to make a difference. And it, you know, what we observe in the marketplace is that when independent asset managers do that, there is an initial bump where you can kind of influence this new tide of sales force to increase the distribution to your product. But then over time, you've got to, you know, the advisors are going to you're going to have to compete for their dollars with everybody else. So we don't think there'd be a big enough payoff for us to go down that road.
Okay, so what I'm hearing there is then Smith & Williamson proceeds are not going to be used to go out and buy a financial planning network.
That would be a reasonable conclusion.
But the real question is, you know, and you answered this a bit yesterday with the conference call, but maybe we'll get into it anyways, is expected use of proceeds. I think that's a big question for investors and shareholders. So maybe you can walk us through your thought process on how you weigh each of your options, right? What you've highlighted is, you know, debt repayment, share repurchases, and reinvestment back into the business.
Yeah, so the Smith & Williamson transaction, for those of you who weren't familiar with it, Smith & Williamson's a UK-based wealth manager with about 20 billion pounds. And we announced a merger with an organization called Tilney. When those two firms get together, it'll be the third largest wealth manager in the UK. And we effectively sold it for proceeds totaling $320 million, and we'll keep a stub in the new organization of around $40 million Canadian. But when you run through the math, net of fees and taxes and whatnot, we'll be able to pay off all of our debt, and we'll have about $120 million of cash on our balance sheet. And as far as debt goes, we'll pay down debt simply because if we don't have another immediate use for it, it just is the most prudent thing to do. But we're not averse to having debt. And so, you know, we could take our debt to EBITDA up to 1 very comfortably, and we'd be fine taking it up to 2 if there was something strategic or a compelling opportunity for growth. So, again, that leaves us with a balance sheet of about $300 million to grow. And I would say that growth is probably our priority. And we've got a lot of opportunities to do that. We can talk about those, but we do want to think about our capital management in a balanced way as well. So I think return of capital to shareholders will definitely be part of that as well. And we expect to be active on our NCIB.
Okay. So just continue that discussion for a minute before the reinvestment and pursuit of growth. How do you weigh the options of NCIB versus SIB, right? Given you're getting a big chunk of cash all in one time, why not go out and buy back a bunch of stock and a bullet payment?
Yeah. We basically would consider anything. But I would say that it's kind of a dynamic situation where, you know, And there's a bunch of things that kind of go into the decision in terms of growth versus return of capital and how much capital. So, first one's probably the share price. The second one is the opportunities for growth. The third one is the timing of the receipt of cash from the sale of Smith & Williamson. The deal was announced. It's expected to close in Q1. But again, we don't know precisely when we're going to receive the cash. And then just general state of the markets, right? And so we're not in a position where we want to declare anything concrete around what we're doing, but those are the things that are going to factor into our decision. And as I said, it's dynamic. It could change week to week or month to month as far as how we're thinking about it.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit more about that reinvestment option and pursuing growth. Where would the priorities be on that metric?
So I would say one of the big areas has to be alternatives. And the reason for that is it's something that our clients are asking for. It's an area that we've already invested quite a bit of time into. In 2014, we established a couple of partnerships. One was with Instar AGF, which is an infrastructure mid-market social and civil. The other was with SAF Group, which is a private credit organization. And we now have, I guess, four private funds and totaling almost $2.5 billion. And when you look at alternatives, what we're trying to do, what we are doing, is building out the full spectrum of alternatives. So I mentioned briefly the private side, and I've already talked about the public side. But we want to be regarded as a global asset manager with capabilities in the alternative space. And we think that the next area of development is going to be something around bridging the gap. So if you look at the people who are really good at providing real assets, alternative investments, they have the capabilities of doing what they do in-house. They have people inside their organizations who do it. They probably have access to institutional investors. They don't have access to retail. You have organizations that have access to retail and institutional, but they don't have in-house alternative capabilities. So when you look at what AGF can bring to bear in this market, we've got internal capabilities. We have access to retail distribution. We have access to institutional distribution. We've got $6 billion in private client assets in three offices across Canada. So we really have the full spectrum that you need. So what we'd like to do is bridge the gap between private and public. So if what our IIROC clients are telling us is that they want to put more money into alternatives, most of them cannot do a 10-year lockup on an infrastructure fund. Even a 4 or 5-year private debt fund would not be possible for them. And I talked a little bit about our capabilities in the quantitative and ETF space. One of the ones we have is we have a global infrastructure ETF. We have one of the few global actively managed bond funds. So there's opportunities to pair an equity infrastructure ETF with a private asset and offer it in a vehicle that has liquidity privileges and offer that into our retail channel. So I think that's where you'll see us focus over the next couple of quarters, is trying to figure out a way to marry those two worlds that we've developed capabilities and a reputation for.
Okay. That's very interesting. So in terms of the investments that have been made on the infrastructure side to date, have returns met your initial expectations, or how have returns looked?
Yeah. So the returns that we've received so far, so we started this in 2014, it's largely been as an LP investor. And the returns have met or exceeded our expectations. Just a couple of anecdotes. So the infrastructure platform was seeded with $100 million, and that went to facilitate the transaction to purchase Billy Bishop Airport. That seed investment has already been monetized, and it's not public, but it was done at a very attractive return that we're very happy with. Our private credit operations were seeded with $50 million. That seed asset has also been monetized. That was monetized at a 65% IRR. So, obviously, we're happy with that. And the LP returns have been, in the range of 12 to 14%, and yields in the 3 or 4% range. The cash yields will increase over time, because as we're doing deals in the funds, it tends to reduce the amount of cash that we can pull through. But the strategy here is not to be an LP investor, because if you want to invest in HEF stock to get access to a limited partnership, you can just invest in the limited partnership yourself. What the idea is to generate recurring fees. And what we're trying to do over time is limit the amount of treasury capital that goes into seeding these strategies and increase the amount of earnings that come from management fees. So on the private debt platform, we've probably booked 2.5, a little bit more than that, in management fee profits. And on the infrastructure side, we have not. And the reason is because that platform has grown so quickly that we've had to reinvest in the platform to build teams big enough to handle the investments that need to be made to satisfy the commitments. But we're now at a point in the Instar AGF platform, which is our infrastructure platform, where we have in the $2 billion range of commitments, and we've done the first investment in our second fund. So when you do the first investment of a fund, you basically call management fees from the date of the first commitment. So, and this is what we talked about a little bit on the conference call yesterday, is that starting in Q4, we expect to have an annualized management fee return of about $3 million coming from our interest in our private GPs. So that'll increase over time as it scales. Good. And we have a target of being at $5 billion in the real asset space over the next couple of years.
Okay. So we have time for one more question. I just want to flip topics, because I think it's still an important one, is you've brought out some what I would call relatively aggressive operating cost targets for this year, and you're going to provide some guidance for next year at a point in time. But can you talk about those OPEX targets and why they won't necessarily challenge your sales trajectory?
Yeah, I mean, we're at the same time that we've been taking costs out of the business, we've been making significant investments. So if you think about it, in 2017, we had a cost base of $200 million, IFRS 15 adjusted, for the accountants in the room. And next year, we've said that we want to trend closer to 180. So, call it a $15 million expense reduction at a time when many other asset management firms were talking about, what percentage of SG&A increase were they going to guide to. And like I said, we made investments in our quantitative capabilities, our infrastructure, private credit, distribution. But effectively, the way we're looking at it is we're not trying to, rip costs blatantly out of the organization, but the business is changing. And so I referenced process improvement earlier. If there's something we're doing that is meaningful to the client, we're going to continue to do it. If there's an investment we have to make for growth, we're going to do it. But the business has just changed so much that there's enough things that we used to do over our 60-year history that is just no longer productive, that we feel like we can take the costs out without disrupting the client. And we're really not approaching expense management from the perspective of trying to target people or trying to target having a smaller footprint. It's really more so around customizing our business for around the client.
Good. I think we'll leave it there. Adrian, thanks very much for joining us. Appreciate your time and your thoughts.
Thanks for having me.